You're listening to the Expression Engine Podcast, episode number 72, with special guest Leslie Doherty, here to talk about framing logic. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by EE Coder, the EE experts who play well with others. Do you sometimes wish you had a trusted partner for your projects? EE Coder brings over 25,000 hours of EE experience to companies with needs like yours. Let's chat. Contact eecoder.com.
The Expression Engine Podcast would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hi, Leia. How are you?
I'm in a pretty excited mood because I can't wait to get a copy of our podcast shirts. It looks like one of our winners already received his.
I know. That's really fast for the I sent it just regular U.S. Postal Service. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So yeah, I shipped everything on Saturday. So all of our survey and Engine Summit winners should be receiving them this week or next, depending on where in the world they live. Oh, also speaking of the survey, we're in the middle of analyzing our survey data.
And by we, I don't really mean you or me.
No, thank goodness. We're handing it over to an expert. We hired Empirical Path, a digital measurement firm that does audience research and web analytics. A local Albuquerque friend of mine, Peter Halley, he works for them. And he's done this type of survey analysis for me before, and it's totally worth it.
Really excited to talk about the findings and responses. So thanks, everyone, again, to all our listeners for enthusiastically participating in our survey.
Yes, thank you, everybody. So let's go ahead and introduce our guest, Leslie Doherty, probably better known in our community as Mrs. Flinger. Les has been involved in a little bit of everything during her 10-year web career, blogging, design, development, standards, teaching, speaking. She went freelance straight after earning her master's in information technology, but has also worked for agencies and was even the community architect for Ellis Lab. Welcome, Leslie. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. It's good to be here with you guys.
I know. I think I've been trying to get you on for a long time, like a year.
Yeah.
It's been a really busy year. So, yeah.
Well, that actually is a good segue to the first question I had for you. What have you been up to lately, especially since you moved on from Ellis Lab?
Well, it's kind of taken a turn. I've been doing more front-end work with automotive software industry agencies. Yeah, it's really neat. So a lot of the software that goes into cars, the HMI experience, which is in the dash and the headboard there, the user interface, it's really similar to websites in that it's all based on user experience and, you know, it's very interactive. So a lot of those concepts need to be presented to big OEMs like Ford and VW, Audi, Toyota. So they hired me to create demos on the iPad and mobile devices that they take into the meetings and then show the OEMs what their concepts are for the dash. So if they have they want to do a new HMI or they have a new skin that they want to present to Ford for the inside the Ford cars, then we do a demo in HTML5, CSS3, port it to iPad. Sometimes it's native, sometimes it's HTML5 with a wrapper. And they take it in on the iPad and they let them actually click through and see what their concept is visually. So it's been really fun. It's been a super crazy year. I've been to about 7 countries. And
oh my God.
Wow.
It's been fabulous, but very, very busy. But I absolutely love it. So in the middle of all that, I still do some work with Expression Engine. I put Electrobit, which is one of the automotive companies that I work for right now. We're putting them in a EE right now, their website. So I kind of am a little bit of everywhere still, but it suits my ADD well when I have a lot of different tasks. So
nice.
Now, are you freelancing and they're hiring you out, or are you working for an automotive company itself?
No, I'm still freelancing. I'm dating different companies right now because I can't really settle down. It's been so neat to get so many different experiences that I work for 2 different companies that are actually partners. So I do a couple of days a week in one, a couple of days a week in the other, and then I still take jobs on the side. So I'm kind of just have a chance to just kind of taste different companies and see what they're like and how they work. And I'm really enjoying it. you know, one of the companies wanted to marry me and hire me on full time.
Oh, wow.
But I was just, it wasn't quite the perfect fit. It's close, but so we're working on that. But yeah, I'm not sure if I'm ready to settle down yet. It's been a really good ride doing the freelance this year. So
that's great. And I really love what you described that you're doing. We often forget that the things we know for designing for an interface aren't necessarily restricted to a web application or even a mobile device application. That's fascinating that they're using that sort of design influence in car design.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was at Detroit Telematics a couple weeks ago, and HTML5 is becoming very big in the HMI, the in-dash interactive. They're actually doing a lot of HTML5 development with that. So it's really a neat time to kind of be in this front end industry where you can really go to a lot of different things and do a lot of different applications.
So mm-hmm. Leslie, can I interrupt you for a second? What does HMI actually stand for?
It's human machine interface.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
So yeah, I forget because, you know, we have a different interface with our websites or with our applications and they call it the HMI. They just like to make it sound more foofy. But it's basically the exact same thing.
So Les, all the work you're doing, you say it's definitely more front-end development. It sounds like it's a lot of usability and user experience design. And from my little bit of research I did about framing logic, which is why we've got you on today, it kind of sounds like that's what that is. It's user experience design. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. It's something the term framing logic is something I kind of made up for a talk that I did a couple of years ago in Bellingham. It's a way of describing how to organize the back end of Expression Engine so that it's very user friendly, it's very easy to administer, and it makes a lot of sense for the person on the front end as well. So it's basically just a way of a concept of organizing your content and how you're going to do your data entry on the back end so that it's most friendly for both sides.
So this concept of framing logic, does that come from back end development or some sort of programming theory?
Yeah, I have a background in PHP and back end programming, so it probably comes from that. It's just a way in my head, I had it thinking of just a way to organize your content and your structure for your administrators who are going to be doing the updating on the website.
What I think that's interesting about this is that I think sometimes as developers, when we're implementing stuff for Expression Engine, we're thinking about how it helps us to implement the site easier, but oftentimes we sometimes forget that we're not the ones administering the content at the end of the day. It's going to be the client.
Exactly.
So was this something that you have sort of always gone into your projects with or something that evolved?
Definitely something that evolved. I think exactly what Leia said, where originally when I first started using EE, I was thinking as a programmer how I wanted to have everything set up and organized. And as I was training my clients, I started to see consistencies in what their brains expected as opposed to what mine did. Mm-hmm. And I realized I could make it a much more user-friendly experience for the administrators of the site. And by doing that, then they're more successful. They're more likely to update their site. They're more happy with the content itself. And I think that it's really kind of developed over time just from working with different clients to see what it is that they expected and what they were looking for.
What are the major expectations that clients are looking for that sometimes we as developers miss when we're implementing?
A lot of the things that they really want simplicity. I think as a developer, it's very easy for us to map out. We can look at code and see the matrix. I mean, we can look at lines and reams of code and kind of understand what's going on. And what they want is just absolute simplicity. They don't want to see categories that they're not going to be adding any content to. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times as developers, we put categories that make sense to us because it organizes the templates in a certain way, but they don't care about that. What they want is to go in, click as few times as possible to get their content entered, have it be extremely organized, have it be very obvious what they're doing, and then they want to get out. Mm-hmm. So where I don't mind looking in the code to see, remember that this field maps to this area on the site, they just want to go in and start updating it.
So you mentioned categories. I guess this starts then before you even begin development, sort of in how you're planning where your development's going to go?
Yes, yes, it definitely starts. One of the things that I like to do is work directly with as close as I can to a UI person, depending on what project it is. So you work closely with the UI person or the designer and say, this is how it's going to be organized on the front end. And then from that, I immediately start mapping it on the back end so that we can work together to make sure that everything that's going to happen on the front end that they want their front end user to experience makes a lot of sense on the back end for my back end user. Mm-hmm. So I definitely like to start this way early on in the project because to get it set up correctly, I like to start it basically almost simultaneously as the design is happening.
Yeah, and I think this just brings up a point that I'm constantly stressing with my clients that even though I may be doing expression engine development for them, they need their content really close to final. Their content strategy needs to be clear and their content itself needs to be pretty close to how they want the user to experience it because you can't plan design or development unless you really do know what the end goal is.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of people go backwards from that. I've noticed that a lot. One of my recent clients actually did that exact same thing. And unfortunately, coming in later in the project, we're actually having to undo a lot of what they already did. So it saves a lot of time and a lot of money if you can think long-term first and then work backwards.
So how do you do that sort of like a practical example? Let's say you're dealing with an expression engine CMS. What are some of the key areas that you sort of think about during this early planning phase and how you're going to sort of map everything out and organize it so that you still get that good developer experience for you, but really good user experience for the content administrators?
One of the first things I do is look at your sitemap and your main areas. A lot of the times it's really obvious what should be a channel and what should be a category. So if there's an events area and a news area, and for one of my clients, there's different products, there's HMI, there's services, there's applications, that becomes really obvious. Those are clearly buckets of information. And so I would assign those to channels. But some of the smaller nuances, the types of news, the types, if it's a product announcement, if it's a different, a PR news piece, that would be a category. So those are really simple things that you can kind of think about as you're looking at it and how to map it. But sometimes it's not super obvious. And so that's when it gets to be a little challenging, where when you're looking at the content to make sure that you're mapping it so that it makes sense on the back end, sometimes you have to get a little creative and say, what is it that's going to make the most sense for them? And it might not be that the channels are going to be as obvious as they would be in another site. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. One question that came to me as you were describing that, do you ever end up in a situation where you create something on the CMS that as a developer, maybe it's not the most efficient, but it ends up being a better scenario for your client?
Yes, often actually. And that's one of the things that gets a little frustrating with, if you look at the way things are set up sometimes, I will sometimes do it where as a developer, I would cringe. Why in the world would I repeat these fields? But for my client, it made the most sense for them to make their updating as easy as they could. So sometimes I will do that. And, it's all about making your client happy. And at the end of the day, I want them to be able to update their site easily. So if I am not going to be a developer snob about it, I'm going to make it easy for them.
I think that's a pretty good example because that's something that, I sometimes struggle with, the repetition of custom fields because, whether or not I want to have one giant field group with all the fields and then custom show hide, or even if it's going to have three of the same fields, do I just make three different custom field groups? And at the end of the day, in terms of client simplicity, oftentimes separating it into different custom field groups, even if it pains me to have that type of repetition, is clearer for the client.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I know one of the things that's really helpful in that exact example is to have very clear notes on your custom fields.
Yeah.
So that's where it becomes, I think that's exactly that situation where you want to have a description for a field. So if you're going to reuse that same field, it's hard to put in the description for each channel that you would want. So it's just easier to separate those out. And put a description, you know, this is for this channel and it does this. And it makes it a lot more user-friendly then.
Do you ever use something like a third-party add-on like Title Master so you can even override the word title? Because I think certain clients get confused at that label when we use the title field for so many different things that doesn't actually mean a title of a page.
Yeah, exactly. Those are some of the types of secrets that I think there's some other plugins too that I definitely rely on for ease of updating on the back end for sure. But yeah, that's a good example too, because we know where we're placing the title field, but they don't necessarily remember or know, or it doesn't make sense in their brain. So yeah, that's a great example.
Yeah, I love MX Title Control. That's my favorite plugin or add-on for that particular little feature of making the publish form a little bit more user-friendly.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I should have asked this earlier, because it seems, at least in terms of the process, that this would make sense to happen earlier on. Do you do your own user testing, or do you work with, you know, other organizations who have already done this that you reference in terms of understanding how the client wants to maintain content?
I actually work with the client themselves. So I just sit down and we have these discussions really early on. Who's going to be doing the administration? What's their level of experience? If it's going to be, you know, someone, an office manager who knows Word and Excel and isn't very familiar with anything else, then I'm going to make sure that I sit down with that person and say, this is the content that we have. This is how we're going to need to update it. And then just work with them. And sometimes it's a team of people, and I'll go in and just work with the team and say, you know, this is the tool we're going to use. This is what it looks like. Get them familiar with it and then work with them to see where they're comfortable and then go from there. So mm-hmm. A lot of it's just individual kind of training almost. And it's all very custom because it just depends on the client. Some clients are extremely tech savvy and they want to have more control, and I'm happy to give them that control and allow them more flexibility. And some clients just want a very simple form. Some clients want to just be able to email in their posts and have it come up. And with, you know, Expression Engineer, you can do that. So sometimes I'll just set up and say, here's your email form. You're going to email this in and it'll automatically show up. So it just depends on the client. So I just do this by working directly with them.
In terms of, you know, workflows, have you found any other add-ons that you use that sort of make the user experience in the control panel better for your clients?
Yeah, I have a couple that I use pretty religiously. The matrix field, I think, is an obvious one, because it's so flexible and it's very user-friendly. I also use low variables for setting up things. Yeah, love low. And there's actually a really neat, I use Freeform all the time.
Really?
I do, as opposed to Safecracker. I know. I use Freeform.
Yeah.
I think because I'm old school that I've always used Freeform, so I've not gotten into the habit yet of Safecracker. Mm-hmm. But one of the really neat add-ons, there's an article by Trevor Davis. It's trevordavis.net. And I'm sure we can add these, but there's a Freeform plus Field Frame article that talks about how you can make your forms that your clients can create very user-friendly on the site of the backend itself. So you know how a lot of the times with forms, we create them and then the client just kind of updates, or just kind of, the forms are always so tricky, I think, to clients. It's probably the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. So this actually gives them a lot more flexibility. It allows them to put in all the content of the form itself. I thought it was really neat. And maybe that's something I'm missing in Safecracker, which I'm shamefully saying that I'm not very familiar with.
Well, I mean, Safecracker, one of the maybe caveats, I don't know if you would consider this a caveat, is that it saves it into channels. And maybe that's not where you want to save the data. Like you, right. You might want to have that separated, especially for the user experience of your client. For me, like I always try to keep all channel stuff related to pages or news or like repeating information, those kind of things. But whenever I think of something like forms or one-off items, having that stored in the channels might be a little bit of a performance overkill.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I've kind of just always done it that way. And it seems to work the best. I haven't really needed a change. So it's just kind of how I've done it. But it's definitely, I think the Freeform plus Field Frame has definitely been a great user experience for my clients.
Interesting. Have you started playing around with any of the new form add-ons like ProForm? And there's a couple of them. I think DevDemon has another form creator out there. Have you played around with those?
No, I haven't. I think that's where I get a little developer-y old school,
where
I kind of just go at it sometimes with the same chisel that I've always gone at it.
Yeah.
Where I need to kind of come back out and reevaluate what the new tools are and everything.
Yeah, I think that's something we all struggle with. I mean, there's only so much time that you can try something new when you have something that does already work.
Right, right. And it's, I mean, I love learning all the new stuff that's out there, but there's just so much new stuff that's out there that I tend to jump, like I'll jump into Objective-C or something as opposed to looking, you know, making this particular thing better because it feels like you've got a handle on it and it's okay. I'm efficient in this area. So then I'll go and actually jump out of that area when I could still make this area more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, there's nothing wrong with that at all. In some ways, I think that's even better because I think a lot of new expression engine developers just throw a whole bunch of add-ons onto their site and like overrun it with just because it's got form functionality, let's put it in there. But, you know, people need to think about what functionality is actually in that add-on and it might be way overkill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And way intimidating to the client because when you look at like Field Frame and Freeform, it's so basic that it's really hard to get intimidated. And then sometimes when you look at some of the other add-ons, which they're feature-rich for a reason because people need those features for different clients, right? But if you've only got simple needs, there's no need to like throw every single third-party add-on that has every single feature that you'll disable anyway or try to hide.
Exactly. You know?
And that's going to waste a lot of time and frustration in kind of setting that up when all you need is something pared down.
Exactly. And I think coming from a CS background early on, when I adopted Expression Engine, I was just coming out of my master's. I was really into the computer science-y part of it. And so WordPress was popular, movable type was popular. Mm-hmm. And I remember just looking at some of the code of the plugins that was added that, you know, people would just toss into their sites and just cringing. And I think from that experience, I've always tried to keep add-ons to a very minimum because it's code that I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's some obviously some well-established add-on developers and I know that their code is solid, but then there's a lot of those add-ons that people can just throw in there that it's not necessarily, you don't know that code, you don't know what's going on. If there's a problem with it later, you're not going to have an easy time troubleshooting it. It just becomes very sticky to me to have, it's basically having too many chefs in the kitchen where there's just all this different types of code that's thrown in there where I tend to keep most add-ons out and try to do it myself or, you know, using the tools that are there or very few, you know, reputable add-ons. I'll use those, but.
Yeah. And I think people also forget that there's performance issues when you're trying to use too many, you know, add-ons as well, because.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because they're hitting the database in certain ways or they're storing data in a whole bunch of different ways anyway, that's unpredictable that you don't necessarily know or can control because that's how they've decided to store that data. And then when you try to load all those, let's say you're using so many third-party add-ons that store their data in so many different ways, and then all of them need to load one page. That means right. there's a lot of hits to the database just to load perhaps possibly simple information.
Right.
And then, of course, there's also the additional layer of complexity that add-ons introduce come upgrade time or update yep. time.
Yep, exactly. Because then you have to watch those and for compatibility, depending on what version you're going to. And
so you mentioned a couple simple add-ons you use. What do you use out of EE just native to sort of make a pleasant experience for your clients on the control panel?
Well, a lot of what I do is, and this is going to seem really obvious, I think, but a lot of it is based on hiding the areas of the control panel itself. Mm-hmm. So I always create, I'll create layers of administrators on the back end. And like I mentioned, the office manager, they're not going to want to see any of the modules, you know, templates, any of that stuff. So I will hide all those things and put a member group for that administrator that's very, if she's going to log in and need to update, I'll even lock down the channels. So if she's going to need to update the news and that's it, I will give her access to the news channel and nothing else. It makes it a lot easier for them to come in and step through, and it's easier for training. It's easier for them to maintain. And then those other clients that are very savvy and want more control, I'll open up those other areas and let them have that as well. So
Do you use published layouts?
I don't.
Really?
I don't.
I think you should look into it.
I think I should.
save it for your very last step, though, because there are some little buggy issues. But it's that same idea of, you know, hiding things that certain member groups just don't need to see.
Great.
So how do you document all of this? So you're planning all of these things. You've decided this needs to be a category channel, and here are the add-ons that you're going to use. You've put all these buckets. Like, how do you document this, or do you document this, or what's your process for that?
I do document it, because I'm going to end up coming back and doing some updates, or I'm going to end up, a lot of my business is all repeat clients. So I'll end up going, I know I'm going to go back in a few months or in a year and help them with some updating or whatever. I want to make sure that I remember, because a lot of this is just because I really don't have the best memory. So I know how to make sure that I stay on top of things. I have to write everything down. And it's part of the training experience too. So a lot of the times I am very, very visual, and I just kind of take that into my clients. So I'm going to assume that they need not only just a written documentation of where everything goes and what it means, but also visually what's happening. So I'll take screenshots of the front of each page, and I'll put on there, you know, this field maps to this area. This field goes here. So then it's very easy to look at it and say, okay, you know, the quote unquote title or whatever it is, you know, it actually is the heading one of this area or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I make sure that it's visually mapping the front end to the back end and keeping that in a document and giving that to them so that they can reference that. Because a lot of the time someone else might come up and need to start updating their site, and they, you know, instead of having them need to go through and explain everything in their own way, it's helpful to have just something that they can say, you know, here's what we got from the developer. This is what we do. This is our process. Because the whole updating a website process is something in a large company that can be very tedious and hard to establish. Because there's a lot of, one of my clients right now, there's 1,500 people and nobody, not a single person to update the website. They've got probably 10 people doing their own thing on different sites. So we're bringing everything into one, and it's going to be a group of people, but you have to make it very, there has to be a lot of continuity there. So it's just really good for those kinds of situations where you have it all documented, you can hand it out. There's no confusion. Everybody knows kind of where it is that their area is to update. And it gives it a, for the front end person, you want that singular voice. You want the site to have a consistent message, a consistent voice. And for me, that's one of the ways that I've been able to train my clients to do that, is to just make sure it's all written down, it's all laid out, everybody's on the same page. These are the expectations.
Do you go to this level of detail with all of your clients? you know, or do you have smaller clients who maybe don't have the budget for, you know, that level of training and documentation?
Well, yeah. So some of my clients won't have as much, but I will at least, at the very minimum, I tend to do a screencast of updating and for training purposes, because a lot of my clients, I mean, right now I've been really fortunate to work in the office of several, but some of them are remote. And so in those situations, we'll do a training session online. I'll share my screen and I'll do a screencast and then I'll let them have the movie. And then I'll just do a quick write-up. So it won't be nearly as intensive or intense, but it'll definitely still be reference. They can still always go back and look at that. And I know as a teacher, and I know you guys both teach as well, that, you know, the first time they hear the information, it's not going to make as much sense as they hear it the second or third, or once they've experienced it, they're going to want to go back. So I try to make sure that that's available.
So when you are, to a degree, customizing your framing logic or the design for the CMS for each client, is there a, you know, like sort of like a foundation process that you follow, and that foundation is what you modify to suit each client?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's that's it exactly, because there's always kind of a standard process, I think, as you'd go. And I'm sure you guys both have your own kind of starting point that you do for your projects now. Once you've been doing this for a while, you kind of know, you know, this is kind of my boilerplate. These are my add-ons. This is how, you know, most sites fit into these sorts of categories or buckets. And you kind of go from there. And so it becomes a lot more efficient. You know, most sites kind of have an about us, you know, there's some kind of basic buckets that are usually there. And those things are really obvious and simple. And then you kind of build from there. So what does this other client have that maybe doesn't fit into my normal structure? And then you add that in.
So do you start with a boilerplate yourself? Like, do you actually have like a base install?
Yes and no. I do, but I don't like it anymore. I'm in the process of creating a new one, because it's one of the problems with that is, you know how, and I think I heard this somewhere, I can't remember where, but anytime that you launch something and you don't hate your code, you're not learning fast enough. So every time I launch a site, I always do the best that I can from the ground up. But then as soon as I look back at it, I think, oh, I could do this better. And so I'm always learning. So my boilerplate ends up being, I end up taking half of it out anyway, because I learned from last time, I don't like this, or this jQuery is updated, or, you know, this performance was too slow on the last one. I want to make sure that I don't use this jQuery plugin or whatever it is. So I don't, I mean, I have some basic templates that I go from, but I end up tossing everything in by hand anyway.
Yeah, I totally, totally relate to that, because every time, you know, people talk to me about, oh, well, we do have this base install or whatever. You know, for example, I don't know if you've heard of Stash.
Yeah.
This new add-on that's the new hotness, apparently. And now it makes me feel like scrapping everything I've done and starting from Stash and, and then dealing with things that way. And I totally agree with you that if you end a project and don't feel at least mildly dissatisfied that you could have done it a little bit better, you know, then you might need to do a little bit more learning. And I mean, that's kind of my, you know, approach whenever I do a new project. There's always a better way to make it faster, better user experience, better this or better that. And when you have a boilerplate, then we all kind of have a starting point. Everyone's going to have a template and usually like a static page and then like an entries page or whatever, right? Like those things are generally the same, but in terms of implementation and expression engine, things like low variables didn't exist a couple of years ago, right? And so we had to make do with whatever else. And even in this current show, we were talking about like the new form add-ons that definitely didn't exist a year ago. And you're always having to constantly think about, you know, what's a better process for you and your client. And when you have a boilerplate, that kind of pigeonholes you to only one process.
Right. And I think that's what I love about this work, is that it's never boring. There's always something to learn. There's always some new shiny thing that you can get into and use. And I love that about this. So yeah, I definitely think always, it's kind of one of those catch-22s where you have a process that you're comfortable with, but then you want to make sure that you're always bettering that process. And then it's just the time, and it's just time and learning.
Yeah, I'm only ever truly comfortable with the process if I'm not looking closely at it. Like I haven't really paid attention.
Yeah.
So Les, you mentioned something about one of the things you like about what we do is just sort of the constant learning process. I'm curious because I talked to you over, I think it was just about a year ago when I was up in Seattle and you were talking about, you know, wanting to sort of mix up what you were doing each day. And then it was more of a back-end focus you wanted for yourself, but it sounds like you're doing more front-end. Do you anticipate getting into any more back-end development in the future?
I don't know. I think I've kind of taken a love to JavaScript and Objective-C with native app building and things like that. So there's languages out there that I've learned that I really enjoy that I'm learning them. And I think things like PHP feels a little bit clunky to me at this point. It's rusty for one. My PHP is rusty. I have to look things up now that I used to remember and that it just makes me feel old. And, I used to know PHP before it was object oriented people. That was a long time ago. So I've kind of moved more into just from working with the demos and all that stuff. I've realized that I'm more efficient at front-end programming than I am back-end. And I don't know if that's just from experience now. I remember feeling much more comfortable in the back-end and saying my front-end was crap. I was like, do not hire me to do your front-end. I'm much more efficient. But then through process and learning and experience and getting shoved into the uncomfortable things, which I think is great for you in your career, you learn and you develop and you realize, wow, I am actually more efficient at this. So I've been doing, you know, JavaScript and more implementing with jQuery and try to do some Python and Objective-C. I'm just kind of jumping into. I went to WWDC 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, and absolutely just drooled over native app building. So, I mean, I don't know that I'll ever go back to back-end stuff. I think that I'm really happy and comfortable and learning this stuff. And there's so many applications for it now with HTML5. You can, you know, I mean, we're talking about cars having HTML5 in there.
I know, that's,
so,
yeah.
I don't see a need to do PHP anymore or Java. I hated Java. I don't personally have a dying need to do C++ or Java or anything like that now.
Well, that's good. It's nice to hear how that sort of evolves. I think sometimes, you know, you can stay in a position, whether it's with an employer or your own company or whatever, and it's easy to dream about what you think you want to do and then try it. And maybe it's really not as challenging and fun as you thought it would be. But what really stands out for me, and I was thinking about this the other day when we were communicating back and forth, that I think one of the things that having sort of the front end experience that you have and the sort of user experience and design expertise you have, it's nice to have that as a developer. The two come together really well because I think a developer can create functional things, but if you can create that functional thing in a well-designed interface, it's even better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, this is an age-old thing with do developers need to know design and do designers need to know code, and you do in a certain way, or you need to work very, very closely with someone who does. And that's where all the pieces fit together and where it flows the best. And I think that's where the user experience is the best, is when those two pieces, either people or whatever it is, if you work together, then it becomes a much better user experience.
Before we finish up today, are there any resources, whether they're books or tutorials or a presentation that you saw that really helped you either fine-tune your framing logic or make you focus a little differently on your user experience that you can recommend?
Oh, gosh, I don't. I mean, it's kind of just a learned process from just all the experience. I think this is where my memory fail always happens, but from going to EECI and from working at LS Lab and the marketing department there, I was their director of marketing for a while. And one of the good and bad things about marketing is that it's very abstract. And so there's a lot of experience there that comes from just getting a lot of feedback, but then all that feedback can become tangible in how you implement it. So there's a, you know, it's a very abstract concept to how to improve something, but once you get enough of that feedback, it becomes very easy then to kind of implement those changes. I don't know mm-hmm. if that makes sense, but there's so many speakers, there's so much of our community, there's so many, I'm always reading. So there's not any one thing I could point to. It's kind of just a collection of everything that kind of comes together and
yeah, it sounds like the standard answer for our field. You just have to pay attention to what's out there.
Yeah, it's constant, and there's so mm-hmm. much of it that, I mean, I have resources that I don't even know. Like, I don't even remember that I have this wonderful slide that I could look up for this. And I'll, you know, maybe struggle a little bit too long and then remember I have this resource. So yeah, it just kind of, it's so dynamic that it's hard to point to any one thing.
So I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Leslie, for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It was so great to talk with you. In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Right now I'm having the cobbler shoes problem. The children with the cobbler's people or feet or whatever it is. I don't have my own website. I'm seriously actually in the process of building my own website again. It's going to be catapult-dev.com once I launch it, hopefully later this week. So probably by the time this is out. Otherwise, I'm Mrs. Flinger on Twitter and I'm Leslie Doherty on LinkedIn. Those are the best places right now to find me. But new site to be coming soon.
Perfect. Great. Thanks. Now we'd like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, EE Coder and Pixel and Tonic.
We would also like to thank our partners, LS Lab, Engine Hosting, and Devotee.
Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about the podcast, make sure you follow us on Twitter at EE Podcast or visit our website, ee-podcast.com.
And don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we've got the listener mailbag. If you have any questions you'd like us to answer, please email them to feedback@ee-podcast.com. We'll be answering those questions and discussing the results of our listener survey.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for the Expression Engine Podcast. See you next time.
Cheers.